Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Our video gurus have been going back in time examining good World War I films. This comes, of course, as the world commemorates the 100th anniversary of the war. We'll talk about films that look back at a German Allied troop ceasefire at Christmas and the heroics of an Australian mountain regiment and a whole bunch more. With us today, screenwriter Mitch Bryan is a UMKC film professor. Mitch, nice to have you. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
Jason Heck has seen every movie ever made. Jason, good morning to you.
There's like two.
Yeah,
I haven't. Herbie
like
Goes
that.
Bananas and another one. Yeah.
And Laura Vogt is the curator of education at the National World War I Museum and Memorial here in Kansas City. Laura, welcome back to you too.
It is good to be back. Thank you.
Well, Mitch, let's start with an oldie but a goodie. All Quiet on the Western Front. This is about a young soldier who faces profound disillusionment in the soul-destroying horrors of World War I.
Well, it's an extraordinary movie. It was made in 1930.
And book, too.
Yeah. Great book. But to think that this movie was made in 1930, you know, a year after, really only a year after talkies came into being, and that you watch it now and it still has all this power and it has all of this grit and it's a tough movie. Mm. Is amazing because, you know, a lot of movies made in the early 30s are pretty clunky. I think it's a testament to what a real filmmaker who's passionate and determined can do. Mm-hmm. Lou Ayres is great in the lead. It's told from the German point of view. It's interesting because, you know, some of these films are about defending trenches and others are about trying to take trenches, and so this has both. It has an extraordinary scene when they're defending the trench and then they attack another one, and it's really still kind of shocking to watch this happen. It is one of the great anti-war films of all time, and I guess World War I has always been a platform for great anti-war movies because mm-hmm. Unlike World War II, where there's a clear-cut bad guy, you know, there are no Nazis in this situation. There are no real bad guys, mm-hmm. and it becomes just this horrible slog, and you know, everybody on every side must have at one point or another said, can't we just all go home now, please?
Jason, you think this film holds up despite the years too?
Certainly better than the Richard Thomas starring remake. Richard Thomas being John Boy in the Waltons.
Yes,
that was a
right,
remake,
sure.
I think, in the late 1970s. It was pretty wretched. It's an amazing film. Poor Eric Maria Remarque, you know, Hitler kind of idolized the World War I soldiers, the Lancers, the German just guys in the trenches, because he had been a corporal. He had been wounded by gas. And when the Nazis came to power, the author of this book had to flee Germany in a big way because it was viewed as a betrayal of all the men who had fought and died for the glorious cause in World War I. And so he became sort of this fugitive and had to flee to America on an ocean liner and gave this amazing press conference on the liner to all these reporters who were following him over saying, you know, what are you going to do now? How do you feel about Germany? And he gave this really amazing, impassioned sort of anti-Nazi diatribe that really ensured that he would never, ever go back to Germany. So not only anti-war, but the man himself was quite anti-Nazi, which I thought was a pretty interesting coda.
Who made this film and what do we know about him or her?
Well, Louis Milestone had a long Hollywood career, and this was relatively early in his career.
We have a clip here from All Quiet in the Western Front.
Right, and this is at the very beginning where the Professor Kantarek is telling his students how important it is that they give everything up, including the aspiring writer, Paul Baumer, who's the main character, who, you know, he wants to be a writer. And it's like, you have to give everything up and you have to enlist and you have to go fight in this war.
The fatherland needs leaders. Personal ambition must be thrown aside in the one great sacrifice for our country. Here is a glorious beginning for your lives. The field of honor calls you. Why are we here? You, Krupp, what has kept you back? You, Muller, you know how much you're needed? Ah, I see you look at your leader. And I, too, look to you, Paul Baumer. And I wonder what you are going to do.
I'll go.
I want to go. Count on me. Me, too. I'm ready. I'm not going to stay home.
Yeah! I'm sitting here sort of amazed that this film from 1930, you guys are saying, holds up pretty darn well.
Well, I thought that was certainly – I mean, I wouldn't want to turn in homework late to a dude like that. Obviously, he sounded pretty big. But no, I mean, I think most of us had to read the book in high school.
Mm-hmm.
It was a chore for some, obviously not for me. I kind of dove into it. But no, it's still very resonant. The message of brainwashing youth. We still have child soldiers all over Africa. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, it's not hard to harness the passion of a teenager in what you believe is a righteous cause, and the movie certainly speaks to that.
And the film stays close to the book or not?
Oh yeah, yeah.
High schoolers out there who have read it,
I think back then a lot of literary adaptations stuck very close because they didn't want, you know, they wanted to do. Everybody had read the books. The people actually read back then, and those who were going to the film would have read the book, and so I don't think that they deviated too terribly much, except for sort of matters of expediency and fitting it into 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. And All Quiet on the Western Front was one of the most well-read books around the globe. It was translated into over 20 different languages. It resonated as a book. And so then when you make it into a great film, it's easy to see why it stands up.
That's great. That's great. That film, All Quiet on the Western Front, as we survey some terrific World War I films here this morning with our video gurus. Laura, let's go on to another one here. I'm going to call it Joyous Noel, but which is not the way that you're going to say it, but that's the way I'm going to say it. Yeah.
I'm just going to cheat and call it Joy Noel.
Okay.
It really is a modern-day classic. It is
based on a true story, I should point out.
Very much so. It is this story of the Christmas time in 1914, where all along the Western Front, there are these impromptu truces that are declared between the Belgians and French, British, and the Germans. And so the story—
Truces for the holiday.
I'm sorry?
Truces for the holiday.
Absolutely. A mm-hmm. truce just for the holiday, right around Christmas, just for the day. In some parts, it went from the December 23rd all the way actually through January 2nd. And so this movie starring Diane Kruger, it was actually nominated for an Academy Award, came out in 2005. And since that, it's become a holiday tradition at the National World War I Museum and Memorial.
Mm-hmm. And it's a tradition because why?
Oh, it wonderfully encapsulates, I think, for your heart to feel what we want history to, what history asks your mind to wrestle with about how extraordinary events come from ordinary people, how there is this juxtaposition of beautiful goodwill to all men amidst this horrific public and, you know, horror and warfare that's going on, foreign policy choices that people can't escape.
Give us a little sense, Laura, about how this truce began. I mean, how did these men, these mortal enemies, sort of emerge from the trenches and sort of put down their arms and begin to sort of mingle and come together?
We actually have a really great digital exhibition on our website, www.theworldwar.org, that takes over 120 letters explaining how, from each side, what that looked like in each of the different sectors.
Wow.
Because it's different according to where these folks were positioned. For some, it actually does start with a singing of a Christmas carol, Silent Night, on the German side. The Germans also have the tradition of lighting Christmas trees, and so there are really good historic documents that talk about this happening.
Isn't the story that the Germans began to sing and the men in the other trenches could hear, the enemies across the way could hear it and sort of began to chime in?
They could, because the trenches in many areas really weren't that far apart.
Which is just phenomenal to me.
It's mind-boggling mm-hmm. just how close they were and how little they travel over a span of 4 years. Hmm. That, you know, in some instances, you're deeply entrenched in that particular place. In other places, they talk about a soccer kind of football games that they were putting together, you know, makeshift soccer balls to be playing a game. We actually do it with the Sporting KC. We also kind of commemorate with a soccer game right there on December 26th each year.
What's the story arc of this film, Joy Noel? I mean, where does it go?
Well, it it really ping-pongs back and forth between the Scottish, the French, and the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And it focuses on one character who's an opera singer who is pretty fed up with war and has definitely been taken away from the woman he loves and is definitely suffering, and mm-hmm. who actually sings as in a way almost as an act of rebellion against the high command, and in a way you wonder when he steps out. I mean, he gets up out of the trench, almost as if to invite somebody to shoot him. I mean, there's this really interesting tension between, like, you know, is this a nihilistic gesture, or is this a gesture of goodwill?
So this is the moment he steps out and
sings, and it's this transforming moment for everybody. The interesting thing is there were other instances too during World War I where these strange kinships would develop. I remember reading one story about a Frenchman who could smell the food, and he just got up and walked over to the Germans, and they were so stunned that they just sort of fed him, and he would do it regularly. And then there was another account of the British saying to the Germans, we have to shell you guys, and we're going to blow a whistle before so you can all get undercover. We don't want to shell you guys, but we have to, you know. So there was this
true story.
These are all true incidents that did happen not just at Christmas, but the Christmas one is the one that everybody thinks about because obviously it fits as a Christmas.
So, Laura, the point here is these men were so close together that there actually were relationships that formed to some degree over time.
To some degree, but also just this sense of goodwill to all men that's happening right there at Christmas, the first year of the war, because it doesn't occur after that. This is a war that everyone thought would be over before the leaves fall.
Yes.
It would be over by Christmas. And you have hundreds of thousands of men who are now stuck in the mud, in the cold, away from their families. And there is this moment of realization that brings about this opportunity for these men to really share in that sense of goodwill. I think the clip that we are about to pull up is right that moment after the opera singer comes out and sings.
Okay. This is from Joy Noel.
Good evening. Do you speak English?
Yes, a little.
Wonderful. We were talking about a ceasefire for Christmas Eve. What do you think? The outcome of this war won't be decided tonight. I don't think anyone would criticize us for laying down our rifles on Christmas Eve.
Don't worry. It is just for tonight.
Angel. Donne-moi une bouteille de champagne, mon car.
Danke.
Merry Christmas.
Frohe Weihnachten.
Frohe Noël.
And those are not bombs. Those are flares, right?
Right.
I gather from that.
Right.
You know, one thing I enjoy most about the World War One Museum and Memorial is that one place where you can go stick your head through the holes and see the trenches and see a trench and see what that was like back in the day, because that really, as you began to describe, Laura, this notion of, you know, in the mud on Christmas Eve in the cold, you get a sense of that place when you poke your head through those little holes at the museum. Jason, what do you make of Joy Noel?
Well, yeah, they're absolutely right. I mean, everybody thought it would be a war of maneuver, and these generals, particularly the German general staff, had these brilliant ideas about how to stave off the Russians and knock the French out very quickly. And so everybody was marching and marching and marching, and then it became a race to the Channel, and then everybody sat down and built trenches, and then they put machine guns in the trenches, and suddenly, going over the top with a swagger stick and a whistle, which a lot of the officers still did, became incredibly stupid. And the French, of course, depended on what they called élan. They thought that the fighting spirit of the French army, eager to avenge the losses of the Franco-Prussian War, would sweep the Germans aside. And that's why they had bright blue coats and bright red pants. They didn't think that they needed to have things like field gray or brown uniforms, because their martial spirit would do it. And once you start sitting in a muddy trench and you're standing on and you watch your friends drown in mud when they step off the duck boards and you watch your entire squad cut to pieces when they're trying to take ground that is populated mostly by rats and corpses, disillusion and nationalism kind of fall away. Hmm. And suddenly it becomes important to look for traditions from home and to look for any possible comfort you can and any excuse not to get killed. And it's exactly that. And it kind of didn't happen later in the war, I would guess, because probably officers would sort of frown on fraternization and keep your killing blood up and that sort of thing. But
yeah, they frowned on it then.
Yeah, yeah. It's but once you it was all this youth marching off, especially the British, who were an entirely volunteer army. The British Expeditionary Force was all volunteer, and everybody thought it would be over very quickly, and they would be marching and capturing places instead mm-hmm. of camping and getting shot at.
Does this film get too sentimental, too corny? Anybody?
I mean, some critics had maintained that it did, but
I was going to say it would have that.
You know, it is in the end, it's a Christmas movie.
Right.
You know?
A true Christmas
it's
movie.
It's a Christmas movie, yeah. And so the emotions that are going to, there are going to be wild swings between great joy and great sadness, and I think it's a very good movie.
Yeah. Well, we're sitting here this morning talking about World War One films with our video gurus, and Jason, I wanted to ask you, are some of these films, are they hard to obtain? Can you get them on Netflix, or where do you go to run these things down?
Funny you say that, Stan.
It's funny I should say that. Yeah.
No, it's Scott.
Right, yeah. Sorry. We are actually having difficulty sourcing one, The Light Horseman, and will not have a clip for it. Some of these are oldies, out of printies, as we call them in the business.
out of printies.
They're, some of them can be difficult to obtain. For everyone that has gotten a great Criterion-like treatment like Paths of Glory, yeah, there are some that have fallen through the cracks. Mm-hmm. So I will say it's, yeah.
Yeah, I actually, there were two of them. Being my first time with the DVD gurus, I offered up some of my favorite films. I'm like, oh, Jacques and Shoulder Arms, I love them. No problem with silent films on a radio show, right?
Chaplin just doesn't play on the radio yeah. anymore. Yeah, right? We're hoping to do City Lights.
But a word to Chaplin. I mean, that is it's a terrific movie.
Shoulder Arms is great, and it's also symptomatic of how the industry was changing at that. I believe yeah. that was when Chaplin signed a one-year contract after he left Keystone to the tune of $670,000 a year in 1917 money.
Real money.
Chaplin was one
no
of the
taxes.
First. Yeah. It's fascinating. You know, if you want to look at how movies themselves were changing, follow Charlie Chaplin's arc.
They actually introduced taxes for World War One to movie stars. There's a really great clip inside the audio archive booths talking about Cecil B. DeMille and how they end up taking some of the money, and that the actresses were quite pleased to give up their funds to support the war effort because they were very pleased with being able to be in this country and to continue their freedoms.
That's right.
It's really interesting.
Chaplin said he registered for the draft here but was never called. He got a lot of flack for not joining the British Army. He was still
very
a British citizen.
So.
And if you look at the highest grossing movies during World War One, I believe it was Birth of a Nation, Intolerance, Cleopatra. People were kind of looking for fantasy. They were looking for big stories. They were looking for some escape. And then Shoulder Arms came out during the war.
October 1918.
1918. And you know, Chaplin got a lot of, I don't know if flack is the right word, but people were very worried you can't make a movie about the war because of what you are. The tramp can't be he can't be a soldier. And actually, it's a charming and very funny movie.
He was worried about it.
Was he?
Yeah, he was. He was very worried about doing the film. But both the British and the American government, because again, Charlie Chaplin is British, they both recognized the power that he brought to the war effort by staying out of the trenches and making comedies. Mm. Being able to laugh is really important in times like these.
There's that amazing photo of him at the New York War Bond Rally where it's a street packed with hundreds of thousands of people, and he's just standing up there doing acrobatic tricks in his comedy drunk routine to sell war bonds.
He did a lot for that.
Was the most famous, right, most famous person in the world. Yeah. Everybody in every continent knew who Charlie Chaplin
at age
was.
26, by the way. He was 26 when he signed for the equivalent of $15 million in modern money.
Yeah.
So how common a focal point then was the war, World War One, when it came to making movies? How many movies were made of World War One? I mean, dozens and dozens and dozens, or what are we looking at here?
I would say dozens. I truly don't know. I would say one of the best that
you haven't
comes
counted them for this show.
I really didn't know.
That's
I know
okay. Yeah.
We have over 80 that you can purchase in our museum store.
Oh, really?
And many of them are actually from that. We've got some silent films and kind of in this classic era, like some of the ones that we'll be talking about a little bit later on. One of my favorites, which is another silent film, is actually called J'accuse, which is an anti-war film from the time frame. So I don't know how many that actually were made, but they certainly span the gamut, because J'accuse is this amazing French film that uses veterans from the war to kind of come up from their graves and be ghosts to haunt those who brought the nations into the war. It's really amazing and very hard to get. Another reason, besides being silent, not to,
to put it
as an audio clip.
Another reason to shop at the museum.
That's it.
I gather the museum must have an extensive collection of movies and silent films from that era.
Yes.
I mean, it goes without saying.
You know, the other thing is that World War I would then haunt cinema until the beginning of the Second World War. All of the great Warner Brothers gangster movies, the backstory of these gangsters is that they were World War I veterans, and it's the truth. Vern Miller from the Kansas City, you know, Union Station Massacre, he was a World War I veteran. So it was something that haunted. It even haunts there's the Forgotten Man segment in Gold Diggers of 1938, whatever it is.
Fantastic segment.
Yeah, so it was in the consciousness very much. You know, even though the Americans were only in at the end, it still was, you know, it was mind-blowing.
Gabby from Kansas City, Missouri writes us this, at KCUR, up to date, two great Aussie-made movies about World War I, Breaker Morant, which I think Kirk Douglas was in, and a very young Mel Gibson in Gallipoli. I was close.
Gallipoli reminds us of why they sat in trenches. It showed what happened in World War I when you attempted bold action. And why they didn't do it too often.
And it's happening 100 years ago now.
That's exactly it.
The Royal Navy is off the Dardanelles right now, flying flags and doing all sorts of salutes with the Turkish.
Do you critics know of either of these, if either of these are available in the U.S.?
Well, Breaker Morant is actually about the Boer War, and it's coming out on
different war.
Yeah, it's coming out in Criterion here in the next couple of months.
Edward Woodward, by the way, not Kirk Douglas.
Yeah, and the Kirk Douglas movie she's thinking of, we'll talk about later, which is Paths of Glory.
Yeah,
it's easy to conflate those two because they're very similar in terms of a courtroom kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Gallipoli, I think she can just head on over to the National World War I Museum Memorial. I believe we've got that in the store.
Okay. Oh, great. Okay. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about a slew of other World War I films, Hell's Angels, Wipers Times, Paths of Glory, and Our World War with our very good video gurus here. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Well, this hour we're visiting with our video gurus here, screenwriter Mitch Bryan, Jason Heck, and Laura Vogt, who works at the World War I Museum and Memorial here in Kansas City. We're talking and surveying some terrific World War I films. And you were making the point during the break, Jason, you were sort of questioning what World War I brought to the world in terms of new technology and new ways of warmongering here. Am I right?
Or? Picking a fight. I was trying to use my words and not my height to bully someone. I simply remarked upon the fact that, to me, World War I was more about evolution in warfare than revolution in warfare. To me, the trenches... Trench warfare had existed since Petersburg. The machine gun had been used by the British with great success in their sort of little brush fire wars, where they used it to stamp out various, you know, tribes. I will say that radio, wireless communication, was certainly a big deal. Airplanes, you know, airplanes will get a lot of attention because of Hell's Angels, and certainly they were glamorous. It was easier to find heroes in the cockpit than in the trenches. So the British had Albert Ball, the French Georges Guynemer and René Fonck, the Germans, of course, the Red Baron, the Americans, Eddie Rickenbacker. But, you know, they didn't do much except reconnaissance, which was crucial to planning offensives that didn't go anywhere. Tanks showed up, and that was great. But look at World War II. Look at what we came out of World War II with. We came out of World War II with atomic power, with jet aircraft. Penicillin blood plasma used to save lives in a real way, with aircraft carriers, with amphibious warfare, with, you know, all sorts of things that are – radar ranges. You like cooking your food in the microwave? That's from radar. The first computers were World War One, World War II, rather. So World War One, I think there were evolutionary steps, but not quite the huge technological revolutions brought about by World War II, which was also, admittedly, a much larger conflict that had much larger resources brought to bear on it.
Laura or Mitch, are you going to argue with this? This is obviously right down his pike, Laura. Good luck to you if you're going to take him on here.
Oh, absolutely. But I'm one, definitely going to win, but two, I might take up too much of our time doing that.
I'll give you 30
seconds.
I
won in the off air time just with one word, which was zippers.
Enjoy the one star Yelp zippers review World War One.
Right?
Museum.
There you go.
That was that. The zipper was the winning point there. But if you go to wireless communications and to wristwatches, to the use of reconnaissance, how often do you use Google Maps? Of course, airplanes are absolutely essential, despite the fact that they didn't move as much as they would have really liked to. That reconnaissance was wildly important. We could get into weaponry as well. But instead, what we're going to do is he's going to come over to the museum for lunch, and we're going to keep that conversation going. And when he comes back, he'll have a different tune.
Well, speaking of the museum, you've got some stuff coming up, some encampment stuff that people might be wanting to hear about.
Yeah.
This is neat exciting stuff.
Right? Actually, come and let the guys, come and let the living history historians
maybe sing a few verses of
that.
Pack Up Your Troubles in Your Old Kit Bag kind
and
of thing.
Smile. Absolutely.
All the Irving Berlin you can possibly stand. All the clamorous ditties you can possibly stand.
It's going to be amazing.
So tell us about it.
We've got to wait until the last documentary that we do here.
What's going to happen?
On Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and on Sunday, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., we have Living the Great War, which is going to be on the southeast lawn of the National World War One Museum and Memorial. We'll have about 20 living historians who are going to have an encampment out there representing various nationalities with their personal collections, some primary sources. They'll also have some replica artifacts. We also have some of my favorite folks in the greater Kansas City area, the Dawn Patrol. They are going to be out there.
What is that? Tell me.
World War One replica airplanes. These folks are pilots. They actually fly these planes around. They will not be flying around the memorial, obviously.
Yeah.
But you should come out and take a look. The planes are exquisite. Hear the stories. It is going to be a really good time
so
for
all that
all ages.
This weekend, and on your website, more information.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, good deal. Mitch Bryan, let's roll on with some films here. Let's go to the film that Jason just mentioned, Hell's Angels. Brothers Monty and Ray leave Oxford to join the Royal Flying Corps. Ray loves Monty. Before they leave on their mission over Germany,
Krasky, you're wrecking it.
They find her and steal another man's arms. All kinds of stuff.
Spoiler alert, Steve.
I'm just telling the story.
Hell's Angels came out in 1930. It started several years before because it started as a silent movie. Howard Hughes was producing it. Howard Hughes flew. There are lots of amazing aerial sequences, and Hughes himself flew the plane for some of them. And then sound came in, and Hughes decided it needed to become a talkie, so he fired the leading lady, replaced her with the 17- or 18-year-old Jean Harlow, hired James Whale, who had just come over from Britain, who was a World War One veteran, to direct new talking scenes. And the film is this bizarre artifact, you know, of that transition. It has extraordinary aerial sequences. It has a very soapy plot that you were just talking about there, but it has things that are really remarkable. It's one of the first films to use a two-strip Technicolor process, or Metricolor is what it was called. Technicolor processed it. So it has a couple of scenes that are actually in color, which was a pretty big deal.
So Gene Harlow
in color.
So not the entire film's in color, just some
scenes. No, just some sequences. And then,
like Wizard of Oz.
And then, yeah. And then per the tradition with silent films, there are also tinted scenes where the whole thing has a blue wash or a purple wash over it. But it is really an extraordinary movie because of the scale, and also because it indicates what would happen, which was that you can do the flyers as men of honor. You can do it starts with a duel. So it's also interesting because it's like a movie that starts with this 19th century sensibility and becomes 20th century. Mm-hmm. The performances are a little dodgy, and James Whale was just getting his sea legs as a director, so there's a certain theatricality to them, and it's kind of shocking when you look at this and then you look at All Quiet on the Western Front, which is the far more modern of the two movies, the one that seems to really have hold of Louis Mawson was a great director. Howard Hughes, not so much, but he fired two or three others before he hired took it over himself and
like
then hired James Whale to come
like
in.
It's like you didn't even like The Conqueror. Come on, man.
So it's a terrific, interesting experience, I think.
And what's the clip we have
and
here
so
from
this
Hell's
is,
Angels?
This is a clip where Monty does not want to volunteer because his replacement had been shot down the night before. He doesn't want to go up and fly, and he gets accused of being a coward.
Monty Rutledge. I don't feel very well tonight, sir.
That's all right, boy. None of us feel well.
But you don't understand.
I think I do, Rutledge.
But I say, sir, you don't understand. There seems to be something the matter with me.
I know what's the matter with him. He's yellow.
Oh, shut up.
Oh, let's say it.
Didn't Harry go west last night because he took this man's place?
Keep quiet, sir.
I'll not keep quiet. He's yellow and we all know it.
That's a lie. I'm not yellow. I can see things as they are, that's all, and I'm sick of this rotten business. You fools, why do you let him kill you like this? What are you fighting for? Patriotism, duty. Are you mad? Can't you see they're just words? Words coined by politicians and profiteers to trick you into fighting for them. What's a word compared with life, the only life you've got? I'll give them a word. Murder, that's what this dirty, rotten politician's war is. Murder, you know it as well as I do.
Hmm. Sort of a proto-Shatner there,
yeah.
Really.
Yikes. What'd you think of this film, Hell's Angels?
Howard Hughes assembled the world's largest private air force to make it. You know, it's something, I think, north of 100 surplus aircraft and, you know, pilots, guys who were, you know, maybe not making as much as they could flying the mail. How many died?
Three died. And then when the one guy wouldn't go up, Hughes piloted the plane itself and crashed it exactly the way the guy said would happen.
It's an astonishing technical achievement that speaks to the extraordinary will and resources of one man. It is his personal vision. It is his personal studio, and the planes were his personal toy, you know, to arrange and how he did it. It's not a great movie. It is a great artifact. It is of its time, and it is certainly the aerial sequences are in fact actually still thrilling because it's really happening. There's
and
nothing.
It's pre-code, so it's sexier than most movies in the 30s. It has this, you can, you know, Howard Hughes being the womanizer that he was, it's a really horny movie, you know. There's just desire everywhere. But you know, the language is saltier than we're going to get for another time.
As you heard,
years.
He just got away with saying "shut up," so that's something right there.
Tell me about the flying sequences and how realistic they are.
They're very realistic. I mean, short of shooting actual bullets, you know, they're doing amazing things with these planes. That they've got Spads and they've got Jennies and they've got Newports and they've actually got Fokker D7s, which was a plane that scared the Allies so much it was actually mentioned by name in the Treaty of Versailles. The Germans had to destroy all the Fokker D7s because it could make any pilot an ace. It was that good a plane. And he's got Zeppelins and he's got bombers, and I mean, it's extraordinary, and it's all being filmed from up in the air and on the ground. And
very little model work. There's a tiny bit of model work, but it's mostly cameras mounted on planes. So it's pretty with these guys actually flying.
So it's the flying stuff is as realistic as it gets. The human interaction, less so. A few models used in place of actors, I guess.
Well, that film is titled Hell's Angels, as we survey World War I films with our video gurus, Mitch Bryan, Jason Heck, Laura Vogt. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Dan in Brookside writes this: I hope you'll mention my favorite film. I'm going to mention it right now, which shows the war from the French point of view, A Very Long Engagement. We have any acknowledgement of?
No, of it. Certainly famous. Have not seen it myself.
Have seen it. If you are a fan of Amélie, you should definitely see this film.
Oh, really?
It has Audrey Tautou in it. It is actually one of the favorite films of our senior curator at the museum. So that says a lot about the actual historic authenticity of the costumes and the set design as well.
Made roughly when? Do we know?
Is like this 6-7 years ago?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a new, relatively new film.
Yeah. We've had a surprising run of many new films about World War I.
Really?
Absolutely. Just recently, The Water Diviner came out with Russell Crowe, beautifully set in Turkey about Gallipoli. There was A Testament of Youth with Kit Harington looking at the life of Vera Brittain. There's actually another one coming up shortly with Meryl Streep coming out in October, and kind of looking at through the lens of the suffragette. And so it's set against that scene of World War One.
And so this is just in the spate of films is because why, the 100th anniversary, or what's drawing the attention all of a
sudden? I think there's two things. I think the 100th anniversary. I also just think that, you know, film is a technological medium. Mm-hmm. And CGI allows the creation of this incredible expanse that otherwise would be, you know, a very expensive proposition.
You don't have to recreate No Man's Land or New York of 1918 when you can do it with computers.
You couldn't do it well. I don't think you can necessarily do it justice before some of CGI versus some of the stuff that was still left over. They actually have some really beautiful films from the era that use the actual No Man Land and the devastated environment. But I think now is that, and the other part is, real stories make the best films. They make the best stories. And so if you're going to be going back and making a film, absolutely, you should be choosing.
I think too, the international film is becoming so international. Hollywood is making movies for the international market. And so it may be that, frankly, I don't think there's much interest in America of making World War One movies. They're just, I mean, I've gone around the block with a couple of different things, and it doesn't, Americans don't see it as that important. But French money, German money comes into the process, and suddenly films.
Germany just threw $20 million at the Red Baron, a dreadful movie, but it was the most expensive production in German history, and that was, 10 years ago maybe? Yeah. Five years ago?
Let's roll on. Laura, let's go to Wipers Times, which is about a satirical magazine that's produced after soldiers discover a printing press, and it winds up boosting morale.
Yes, if we're talking about films that were not made by Americans, this is one of them. It's out of the BBC. It is fantastic. If you're going to watch one thing this weekend, watch this film. It is both my and the Collections and Education Department's favorite film. It features Michael Palin and a cast of excellent actors who most Americans don't know, and it tells the true story of Captain Fred Roberts, who was a mining engineer in his 30s, and along with the 12th Battalion of Sherwood Foresters. They end up pulling this printing press out of the rubble in Ypres, Belgium, which is where they get the name for a satirical paper that becomes very well known as the Wipers Times. Ypres is spelled Y-P-R-E-S. Very difficult for those of us who speak English. And it was a newspaper that was kind of filled with this comedic wordplay and poetry. And they brilliantly framed the theater of war that they were actually living at the time for, you know, their counterparts who were right there in the trenches with them in this kind of context of event. And the film does this masterful job of staying true to the men's humor and spoofery and the war's absurdity, while also showing their actual experiences amid horrific war. And I think it goes back in part to, we've got some really nice CGI these days.
This film was made when, roughly?
2014, I believe, is when it came out.
Oh, it's a very brand new film then. Yeah. We have a clip here from Wipers Times.
What is it? Want to set it up?
Oh, sure. Yeah. This absolutely.
That's what we do here.
Right. Yeah. We do. Yeah. We set them up. This is the men in the trenches. I believe it is going to be Fred Roberts and his second in command, and he's just gotten letters from home, and they're flipping through, reading what is happening on the home front.
Okay.
Good heavens! My wife sent me a clipping from the Tatler. We've been mentioned in dispatches.
What? Fame at last.
What do they say?
We hear news from the front of an amusing periodical designed to entertain the troops. It is entitled The Wipers Times, after the town of Ypres, where its enterprising creators are currently quartered. So, we salute the anonymous wits of the 6th Division.
You're the 24th Division?
Nincompoops.
Oh, dear. Appears we're not to be famous after all.
Oh, damn journalists. Can't they get anything right?
Is that a rhetorical question?
And? You like it?
Well, that's how it's. I can certainly identify. Mitch has gotten a lot of credit for a lot of the bon mots that I've said on this show. So I can certainly identify with their frustration.
Damn journalists.
It's just they don't get anything right, yeah. Especially the locals.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Alexander from Lawrence. Alexander, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Morning. I just want to say hi, Laura. It's me, Alex. I heard you doing a great job. But I wanted to maybe recommend, see if you guys wanted to talk about Oh, What a Lovely War. I think it was directed by Richard Attenborough. The musical from, I think, 1969, shot on Brighton Pier. Just because I'm kind of a big fan of the music of the era, and it's very kind of an interesting musical, kind of based on the songs from that era, though telling kind of a more or less coherent story about a family during the era.
Oh, What a Lovely War, Mitch. You know it?
I do, and based on a play. And in fact, I think you guys did there was a production of it just a couple of years ago at the museum.
There was, with the Kansas City Actors Theater.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Alex, thanks for the recommendation. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Mitch, let's roll on here to a film you want to talk about, Paths of Glory, based on the 1935 novel of the same name. It tells the story of an ill-fated assault on German forces by French soldiers and the gripping consequences those soldiers face when they refuse to follow through with it. This is directed by the late, great Stanley Kubrick.
And it's the movie that really put him on the map. I mean, he had made The Killers and people had noticed that, but I think Paths of Glory was the film that really resonated and you know, largely in part due to the fact that Kirk Douglas was the star and was the producer of the film. It's a film that is very much about the separation between high command and soldiers. It's about an overly ambitious general. As a sidebar, I will say that there were probably more generals killed in World War I than in World War II. These guys actually did get down into the thick of it. But in this particular case, we've got a general who is played by George MacReady, who is ambitious and is a blowhard, is ultimately, I think, a coward at heart, but who insists that that Colonel Dax, Kirk Douglas's character, his men attack an objective called the Anthill, which is really untakeable. And there's this extraordinary scene of assault and that Kubrick shoots in these gorgeous long takes and really puts you in the middle of the action. And ultimately what happens is the men don't succeed, this general orders them to fire on their own troops to motivate them, and they end up retreating. And the general decides that he needs to make an example of these men who retreated, that can't be done again. And they pick three soldiers randomly to basically execute. And Kirk Douglas steps up to be their trial lawyer to try and give these guys a trial in what becomes pretty clearly a kangaroo court. Impeccably directed, and with the typical Stanley Kubrick big performances. George MacReady is over the top, and that's kind of what Kubrick loves. His favorite actor was James Cagney. He likes big performances. And so this is a film with Ralph Meeker is in it and Timothy Carey is in it, and it's all filled with great big emotions, and it's just, you can't beat it.
This film came out when?
1957.
So a little bit, yeah.
Based on the French army mutinies of 1917. In 1917, the French army was essentially ordered to launch a huge offensive that was supposed to win the war in 48 hours by its new commander, General Nivelle. And this is an army that had been completely shattered at Verdun and the Somme, and the men had fragile psyches at that point, and the Germans absolutely wrecked this offensive, and the French divisions began sitting down and would not go back to their trenches until Marshal Pétain, who ended up sort of sullying his name forever in World War II, kind of said, okay, no more attacks until the Americans and tanks show up and longer furloughs, and we'll rotate units out. But the French army, at least half of the infantry divisions, mutinied in 1917, and there would be no offensive action taken for months by them.
The clip we have is what, Mitch?
This is when the general is sort of spelling out what he expects Kirk Douglas's men to do.
This is from Paths of War, of Glory.
Colonel, your regiment is going to take the Anthill tomorrow.
You know the condition of my men.
Oh, naturally, men are going to have to be killed.
Possibly a lot of them. They absorb bullets and shrapnel. And by doing so, make it possible for others to get through.
What support will we have?
I have none to give you. What sort of casualties do you anticipate, sir?
Say 5% killed by our own barrage. It's a very generous allowance. 10% more getting through no man's land, and 20% more getting through the wire. That leaves 65%, with the worst part of the job over. Let's say another 25% in actually taking the anthill, We're still left with a force more than adequate to hold it.
General, you're saying that more than half my men will be killed.
Yes, it's a terrible price to pay, Colonel. But we will have the anthill.
But will we, sir?
I'm depending on you, Colonel. All France is depending on you.
From Paths of Glory.
Go watch it if you haven't seen it.
It's amazing. It's such a great movie.
Okay. Yeah. Well, finally, I hold in my hands the final film, the final World War One film of the day. Laura, let's talk about Our World War. This is, give us a sense, a documentary, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. So we couldn't end without talking about some of the documentaries, and there are great ones out there. If you want to start delving into learning about the war, I strongly suggest actually a different one that's not our sound clip. That is The Great War and the Shaping of the 20th Century. It's Emmy Award winning. It's got narration by Dame Judi Dench. What's not to like about that? Mm. It's based on the work of historian Jay Winter. And there's an accompanying website on PBS that's really great, particularly if you are in the classroom. It really covers a great breadth, makes it very accessible. Strongly suggest it. That is a place to start if you really want to start learning the history. The one that I've pulled a sound clip from is actually a very recent one called Our World War. It is done by the same writers of Our War, which was a BAFTA-winning kind of docudrama about the Afghanistan war. And what they've done is they've taken letters and primary sources from the soldiers themselves, and they have put this together into a new series that, to anyone who really is a World War One expert, they may see that there are a couple of minor costuming errors and a few set misdemeanors. But there is no better film out there that I think catches that sense of modernity that these are teenagers at the time. It just catches that essence, that feel. They end up doing some really interesting camera work. They end up using head cameras in it. They've got a nice indie pop music soundtrack. And so if teachers are looking for a different type of documentary to be pulling into their classroom, this is really one that I think a lot of people could identify with a bit better.
This is a recent film, it sounds like.
Very recent film. It also has an accompanying website online. And the clip that we have is actually talking about the Manchester Pals. It's a well-known story. There's in the time frame, people joined together. You wanted to go in together with your brothers, with your friends. You all joined the same group, which was devastating when that group would go into places like Verdun or the Somme, and there are 20,000 Bretons who die in one day in a battle. That is what happens. But this moment that we're catching in the clip is before, and right as we're riding that wave of excitement, of adventure, of defending everything that it means to be your nationality.
This is from the documentary Our World War.
The war is not going to end in the next half an hour.
Don't go now, I'm liable to start my own.
Oh, yeah, thanks for finishing that off for me.
You're welcome. Now, can we please go and fight the shitting Germans?
All right. Let's go fight the Germans.
Well, that is a little different, isn't it? Yeah.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Kids love killing Germans. Just the kids today. They love it with their karaoke and fax machines and pagers. Yeah. They love it.
What else are you going to add to this one, Laura? Anything else?
Just, you know, take a look. There have been some really great documentaries coming out. For the listener who suggests Marion Bash's The Wailer, which looks at the true story of the late horsemen and kind of that's the Australian version of the cavalry. And the other one, we are showing a very hard-to-get film called From Mayerling to Sarajevo. There's just a 1940 silent film about what I would arm wrestle you is the best love story in history between Sophie Chotek and Archduke Franz Ferdinand. And it's a wonderful, wonderful film. So we'll be showing that in October.
Now, didn't World War I end when Franz Ferdinand was found alive? Didn't he? They've been overseas. overslept.
Steve writes this: what about 1971's Johnny Got His Gun with Timothy Bottoms?
Yeah, Dalton Trumbo. It's a brutal,
rough,
wonderful,
movie.
Yeah, hard, tough, beautiful film.
Okay, I want to thank our video gurus here: screenwriter Mitch Bryan, Jason Heck, and Laura Vogt, and lots of things again going on this weekend at the World War One Museum and Memorial. Go to the museum website for a whole lot more information. Right?
That's right.
Go see the planes on the lawn.
Planes on the lawn. www.theworldwar.org.
There you go. Thank you all very much. Have a great weekend, all. Monday on the show, we check out a way to improve your public speaking through stand-up comedy. Our theme music, not today, but typically composed by Bobby Watson. We had help this week from KCUR's Linda Scher, Bill Anderson, Bill Brownlee, Danny Alexander, Lisa Rodriguez, and Beth Lipoff. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.